You might not want to. It all started when I was studying, doing my BA here in theology, and I was doing the synoptic problem. I don't know how much people know about the synoptic problem, but it's about the relationship between Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and in particular the fact that whereas almost everything in Mark is in both Matthew and Luke, there's a lot of stuff in Matthew and Luke that isn't in Mark as well, quite a lot of which is in both Matthew and Luke together. So how do we explain that? The standard way of explaining it, which is standard in the US and in Germany and really everywhere outside England, is that there was a source called Q. It stands for Quelle, which is the German for source. It's nothing to do with James Bond. And Q was a document that contained all the material, or most of the material, that Matthew shares with Luke that isn't in Mark. Okay? This will become relevant very soon, I promise. And then a man called Austin Farrer, who taught in this university theology for many years, an Anglican clergyman, wrote an article around about 1954, I think, called On Dispensing with Q, arguing that the Q hypothesis was unnecessary and should therefore be removed on the basis of Occam's razor. And just almost by the by, he talked about how he took the view that Matthew's gospel has a hexateuchal structure. So what does that mean? The standard view of Matthew is that it has a pentateuchal structure, that is to say, it comes in five chunks, because there are five blocks of Jesus' teaching in St. Matthew's Gospel. He's clearly deliberately arranged his material, most of which is in fact Q material, into these five blocks of teaching. And people have said, oh, well, now, Moses, five books, first five books of the Bible, the books of Moses, the Pentateuch, five books of law, of teaching from God. Matthew, five books of teaching from Jesus. That can't be a coincidence. He's done it on purpose. He's made Jesus into a new Moses, a second Moses, the Uber Moses, if you will. And Austin Farrer said, actually, that doesn't quite work. Because if you have these five blocks of teaching and you say that each block of teaching comes at the end of a chunk, right? And each block of teaching finishes with a phrase like, when Jesus had finished saying all these words, dot, dot, dot. Well, he says, if you've got, like, chunk A, block of teaching, Jesus finished all these words, B, C, D, E, right? You've still got some left at the end that is after the last time he says, when Jesus had finished saying all these words. That's the sixth chunk, right? So it doesn't have five chunks, it has six chunks. He said, what would the sixth chunk be? Well, what is the sixth book of the Bible, for a bonus point?
Joshua.
Joshua, very good. You see, you were paying attention at the beginning, weren't you? Book of Joshua. And he points out that Joshua in Greek is Jesus. So those Christians who knew their Bible from Greek, which was probably most of them very early on, when they heard the name Jesus, Jesus, what they heard was Joshua. Or conversely, if you like, when they read their Old Testaments and they read about this guy called Joshua, they read it in Greek and he was called Jesus, Jesus. It's the same name. And Austin Farrer said, well, if you grow up with that, it's going to inform your understanding on at least on a subliminal level. It's going to inform your understanding of Jesus in the light of Joshua and of Joshua in the light of Jesus, because you hear the same name when you talk about either of them. They're the same, they got the same name, it's the same thing. And if you add to that the fact that this structuring of St. Matthew's Gospel, in fact, gives you a sixth chunk at the end, then you start to think, well, actually, you know, Jesus isn't another Moses. Moses is clearly a servant of God. Moses is somebody who receives the law. He goes up on the mountain and God gives him the law, which he then communicates to the people of Israel. That isn't what Jesus does. When he goes up the mountain to preach the Sermon on the Mount, he doesn't receive anything. He gives the law. Jesus is not Moses, but he's God, of course. But he's somebody who, in a certain sense, then fulfills and exceeds what Moses has done. And who is it in the Old Testament who fulfills and exceeds what Moses has done? Well, one obvious candidate would be Joshua. Because Moses is given the instruction to lead the people out of Egypt and into the Promised Land. But then, more on this story later, he's told, actually, you're not going to enter into the Promised Land because you were faithless. At a certain point, as I say, more on this later, Moses' faith failed him. And so God said to him, because of this, you're not going to lead the people into the Promised Land. Instead, Joshua, Jesus, is going to lead the people into the Promised Land. So when you put all these things together, Austin Farrer said, you can see how a Christian familiar with the Greek version of the Old Testament and with the story of Moses and how he was succeeded by Joshua, who fulfilled what had been told to Moses to do, might say, well, actually, there are some interesting parallels here, aren't there, between the one Jesus and the other Jesus, the one Joshua and the other Joshua. That, in fact, we might even say that Jesus, Son of God, fulfills Joshua, the son of Nun. And then we could draw further parallels. We could, for example, think about how just after the last block of teaching, so now we've entered into, as it were, Matthew's version of the book of Joshua, the disciples talk about stones of the temple and say, wasn't it all marvellous? I'm paraphrasing, you understand. So I think about Matthew 24, is it? Does anybody know? Will believe me then. It's about Matthew 24. And the disciples say to Jesus, look at all the stones of the temple, aren't they amazing? Isn't it all wonderful? And he says, I tell you solemnly, not one stone will be left upon another, but all shall be thrown down. And this echoes verbally the description of the fall of Jericho in the book of Joshua. So Austin Farrer suggested, and as I say, this is just in an article when he's actually arguing something completely different. He's arguing about the relationship between Matthew, Mark, and Luke. But he suggests, just by the by, that actually Jerusalem in Matthew's Gospel, as it were, functions as Jericho in the Old Testament. It has to be conquered and it has to be destroyed by Jesus, Joshua, before the people can enter into the Promised Land. But of course, the Promised Land for Matthew isn't Palestine, it's not Canaan, it's not what we would call the Holy Land, but is, in fact, heaven itself. So that's how it all started, and I read this article, and it made me think, And then, a year or two later, two years, I think, later, I was doing Luke, Acts, Epistles, and Apocalypse, which is the very last paper that I did before I sat finals, with John Mudderman, who went on to be my supervisor, and he sent me an essay on the letter to the Hebrews. And I thought the right thing to do was to read the letter to the Hebrews in Greek, because I can. I'm a bit of a show-off. And so that's what I did. And I came across this passage. It says, and I quote, "Since, therefore, it remains for some to enter it," there will be more on this, I'll give you the context in a minute, "and those who formerly received the good news failed to enter because of disobedience, again he sets a certain day, today, saying through David, so long afterwards, in the words already quoted, today when you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts. For if Jesus had given them rest, God would not speak later of another day. So then there remains a Sabbath rest for the people of God." If Jesus had given them rest, and I checked, and I checked, yes, I was right about the grammar. This is definitely counterfactual, because there's an indicative in the protasis and the apodosis, and in the apodosis. Yes, it's definitely counterfactual, which means he's having a go at Jesus. That doesn't make any sense. And I thought, what am I not understanding about this passage? Why is he telling Jesus that he didn't do a good job? So I eventually chickened out and picked up this, which is the RSV, Second Catholic Edition, and looked it up. And it says, if Joshua had given them rest, God would not speak later of another day. Of course, Jesus might be Jesus, or it might be Joshua. It's the same name. And he's not having a go at Jesus, he's having a go at Joshua the son of Nun. And then I thought, well, actually, you know, if that made me go, huh? Because when you're reading a New Testament text and you see Jesus, you kind of assume he's talking about Jesus. If that made me do this double take, maybe when the letter to the Hebrews was first written, actually I take the view, most people do, that it's originally a sermon. So when it was originally preached, maybe it made people do a double take then. And maybe it made them think about the fact that Jesus and Joshua have the same name. And maybe they would think, well, what do we conclude from that? And that, I mentioned it briefly in passing in my essay for John, and he said, oh, that's an interesting idea, you should write more about that. But instead I didn't, I sat finals and then went to Leicester to be university chaplain. But then I was asked eventually to come back here and to do a master's and a doctorate, and that was the seed that had been planted had grown in my mind, and I thought, there might be something in this. I'll have a punt on it. If there's nothing in it, I won't get a doctorate. But if there is, then it might even be worth mentioning to some other people. Because part of it, I think, for me, is that the Dominican order to which I belong was traditionally charged by the Catholic Church with preaching the holy name of Jesus. There is a devotion within the church to the holy name of Jesus. And there used to be something called the Holy Name Guild. I think it still exists in some places, probably, does it? And people would join this guild, lay people would join this guild, and they would commit themselves to not blaspheming. It was a guild of people who don't blaspheme or swear. And it was looked after by Dominicans, and there would be in every province a promoter of the Holy Name. I quite liked the idea that one day maybe I would be provincial promoter of the Holy Name. So it seemed to me like a good thing for a Dominican to do a doctorate on was, is there, in fact, then, Joshua typology in the letter to the Hebrews? As you will have heard from Mark, I concluded that there was, and wrote about it in a book. And that's kind of what I'm going to tell you about, what I have been telling you about. So I've kind of touched on Joshua, and I really probably ought to touch on what I mean by typology, oughtn't I? Because Will at least looks very puzzled. So I'm going to talk about what I mean by typology. And the way I explain it is that it's a bit like potato prints. Because a tupos in Greek is a stamp. That's what it means. It's either the thing you stamp with or the image that is made when you stamp with it. Okay? So either a stamper or an imprint of a stamp is in Greek tupos. Another word for it is character. It's the two words are more or less synonymous. And at the beginning of the letter to the Hebrews, we're told that Jesus is the character of God, the stamp of God, the imprint of God. And when you were at school, I don't know if you ever did this, you can cut a potato in half and carve a pattern into the flat surface. Is this ringing a bell with anybody? Good, that's a relief. Sometimes people just look completely baffled by this. But you can do this. Even those of you who've never done it, I want you to now imagine cutting a potato in half and making some kind of carved impression in the flat half. Or you could do it with a lino cut, but it's more fun to do it with a potato. And then if you squish that around in paint, oil paint is best, because otherwise it just soaks into the potato. And then you can stamp the picture onto the paper, right? So maybe you can make the same pattern over and over again, stamp, 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 stamp. That's what typology is. Typology is saying that somebody is the same shape, something is the same shape, the same pattern, as something else, because it's been formed by the original, stamped into some new texture, if you will. More broadly, typology, Christian typological reading of the Old Testament would say, we can look back at the Old Testament and we can see Christ in it in all sorts of different ways. Or we can see particular aspects of Christianity, of salvation history, of the life of the church, foreshadowed, if you will, foreshadowed in the Old Testament. But we would want to make the argument, those of us who do this kind of thing, that in fact what's happened is that they were formed by Christ. If you like, Christ was always going to be the saviour of the world. God knew what he was doing. When he foreshadows something, it's the power of the divinity of Christ, if you like, that makes it possible for Christ himself to stamp that image of himself into salvation history, going all the way back into the Old Testament, as far back as you like. You have the image of Christ in the Old Testament. St. Paul insists on this explicitly, for example, in 1 Corinthians 10. He's talking about the people of Israel in the wilderness, and then the rock that sprung forth with water to quench their thirst. And he says, and the rock was Christ. Presumably, he doesn't mean that it was literally Jesus in disguise, or, you know, scuttling around underneath this kind of polystyrene rock or something like that. Obviously not. But what he does mean is that somehow, in a very real sense, ontologically, that event and the existence of that rock and the fact that it was able to quench the thirst of the people of Israel in the wilderness not only foreshadowed Christ and how he brings forth living water and in a much more profound and salvific sense quenches the thirst of the people of Israel, us, in the wilderness of this world, but that it was precisely because of the power of Christ that that original rock existed at all. Okay? Now, sometimes it's quite hard looking back to discern that things are the same pattern, that you've got this repeated pattern over and over again in salvation history. That can be quite hard to discern. It's easier for us as Christians, I think, than it is for unbelievers to see the pattern emerge. Why? Because we have seen Jesus. Hebrews 2 verse 9, but we see Jesus. In other words, it's like this. The paper upon which these potato prints are stamped out over and over again is not flat and is not on a nice, clean, hard surface. It's torn and it's dirty, it's stained, it's uneven, it's battered, crinkled, etc. So when you get your potato and you go ka-chunk, 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 it's not going to be very obvious that that's what you've been doing. It's not going to be easy to make out the patterns, right? But imagine if you've seen the potato with the carving on it, and then you look back and you say, oh, now I can see, because we've seen the potato. So Jesus is the potato. That is what Christian typology says. Doesn't normally use these words, because what it says instead is, he is the very character of God. But if they'd had potatoes in the writing of the New Testament, I'm sure that they would have said, he is the potato, the living potato that comes down from heaven, of course, not just any potato. Now, how does this work itself out specifically in the letter to the Hebrews? There are two important chunks of Hebrews that I need to talk about. But first I need to talk a little bit about the structure of the book as a whole. Introduction, chapters 1 and 2, the superiority of Christ. Christ is just best. It unaccountably, totally and utterly, in every possible respect, best. That's the introduction, okay? And chapter 13, which is kind of the conclusion, very possibly added on at a later stage. I mean, not much later, but if I'm right, and I am, that originally it was a sermon, a homily preached probably in a Christian synagogue, because they existed in the early times of the church, then I think that probably 13 wasn't part of that sermon, but it was added on afterwards when it was written down to be sent around the church, okay? But then after that, you've got chapters 3 and 4 and 11 and 12 have one, as it were, set of ideas going on in them, and then 5 to 10, another set of ideas going on in them. In chapters 5 to 10, these are the passages that people are most familiar with, and it's about Christ as the high priest. And it's the idea that the ceremonies or aspects of the ceremonies of the Day of Atonement point towards the significance of Christ's death. On the Day of Atonement, please stop me if you all know this, but I don't know how much people know about these things. On the Day of Atonement, it seems, the high priest, and he's the only person who's ever allowed to do this, and only on this day, passes through the veil of the temple, the one that was torn in two from top to bottom on when Jesus died on the cross. The veil that separates the holy place from the Holy of Holies. And the priest would pass through the veil of the temple, taking with him some blood in a bowl, call upon the name of the Lord, which is otherwise never to be pronounced, splash the blood around, and thus purify the Holy of Holies from the defilement that had crept into it during the course of the year from the sins of the people. Because the basic idea was, the worse the sins are, the further in the pollution goes into the temple, thus threatening the holiness of the temple, threatening to drive God out. Ask me more about that at the end if you want to. It's quite a big set of ideas and it's all weird. But the priest would go in and he would say the divine name and he would take the blood and he would pass through the veil. And he had to be the high priest, has to be on this particular day and so on. Now, Hebrews 5 to 10 is really talking about that and how that prefigures, or if you prefer, is a type of Christ. In his death, Christ took his own blood. And he passed, Hebrews says, not into any handmade sanctuary, but into the heavenly sanctuary itself, taking with him his own blood, thus providing an eternal sacrifice. And at one point he even says, cleansing heaven itself. I'll read you that passage because it's very intriguing. Let me just find the right place. Here we are. Yes. So he's just talked about how Moses would instruct Aaron to do the splashy, splashy, splash. And then he says, thus it was necessary for the copies of the heavenly things. Sorry, not a lot of light here, so let me just move that away a bit. There we go. The copies of the heavenly things to be purified with these rites. So what he's saying is the temple, and before the temple, well, the temple itself is really a copy of a copy, because before the temple you had the tent in the wilderness, right? The tabernacle. Actually two tents, that's the point that he makes earlier on. So it was necessary for the copies of the heavenly things to be purified with these rites. Those things are copies of a heavenly reality. But the heavenly things themselves, with better sacrifices than these. For Christ has entered not into a sanctuary made with hands, a copy of the true one, but into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God on our behalf. He appeared once for all at the end of the age to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. That's at the end of chapter 9, and then in chapter 10, he goes on to say that because Christ has done this, entered into the original heavenly sanctuary, of which the earthly sanctuary in Jerusalem is a mere copy, an imprint, a stamp, a potato print, if you will, therefore his sacrifice has an eternal significance because it's a heavenly sacrifice. And therefore, the veil of the temple, of course, represents, if you like, the boundary between earth and heaven. And in fact, that's what you would expect it to represent, because that's what it looked like. The veil of the temple was purple silk, very expensive, because it was dyed with Tyrian purple, which you had to make with seashells, very expensive. And then on it were stars and moon and planets and the sun and so on. So it was the sky. The temple, the veil of the temple looked like the sky. And the, in the Jewish cosmology of the time, between earth and heaven was the sky. The sky was this kind of layer, a dome. And God lived on the other side of the sky. So when you tear the veil of the temple in two, the heavens are open. It's an apocalyptic moment. And he goes on to say, where is it? It's 10:19, isn't it? Yes. Therefore, brethren, since we have confidence to enter the sanctuary by the blood of Jesus, by the new and living way which he opened for us through the curtain, that is, his flesh, let us draw near with a true heart in full assurance of faith. So we can now pass through the veil of the temple. Because Christ has opened the way, he's torn the veil of the temple open once and for all, and we can pass through. With me so far? Excellent. So, that's the basic idea of chapters 5 to 10, is that what goes on Yom Kippur is a yearly repetition of something that in fact anticipates the sacrifice of Christ on the cross by which he entered into heaven. And it's, if you like, you could say there's a vertical typology, if you like. That is to say, it joins heaven to earth rather than past to future. Yeah? The temple is a typos of the heavenly sanctuary. And in fact, that exact word is used in Exodus when Moses goes up Mount Sinai and it receives the instructions on how to make the tent of meeting. He says, be sure you make everything according to the typos of what you saw on Mount Sinai, i.e. in heaven. Okay, so vertical typology, Yom Kippur thing, Jesus is the high priest, goes through the veil of the temple taking his own blood. Right? Now that all makes sense. That'd be a really cool sermon to hear one Sunday. Okay, but in chapters 3 and 4, and 11 and 12, you've got a completely different set of ideas. And it's not at all obvious, though I now know, it's not at all obvious how they join together. Because the set of ideas that we've got here is the idea that the church is typified, typologized, however you want to say it, typified, I think, by the people of Israel, fine, but specifically by the people of Israel during the wilderness period. That we are the real wilderness wandering generation, if you like. That they are a foreshadowing of us, specifically that generation which wandered in the wilderness. And we've got all this stuff then about Moses and Joshua and all that going on. And it's not at all obvious how they link. But I think I know the answer. So what he says, to begin with, is Jesus, the apostle and high priest of our confession, was faithful to him who appointed him, just as Moses was faithful in God's house. So we've got Jesus with Moses. They're linked by faith. Yet Jesus has been counted worthy of as much more glory than Moses, as the builder of a house has more honor than the house. Now Moses was faithful in all God's house as a servant, but Christ was faithful over God's house, not in God's house, as a son. So, yes, there's a similarity between Jesus and Moses, but, as Austin Farah has said about Matthew's Gospel, Moses is infinitely inferior to Jesus. And the measure of that inferiority, if you like, the word that tells you in what way he's inferior, is faith. Moses is faithful in a way, but Jesus is faithful in an infinitely better way, because he is the son and not the servant. Okay? And then, suddenly he launches into exegesis of Psalm 95, which those people who say the Divine Office every day say every day, first thing in the morning, it's the invitatory psalm. And it ends like this. This is the translation from Hebrews. Today, when you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as in the rebellion, as on the day of testing in the wilderness, when your fathers put me to the test and saw my works for 40 years. Therefore, I was provoked with that generation and said, they always go astray in their hearts. They have not known my ways. As I swore in my wrath, they shall never enter my rest. So, this is a psalm, supposedly written by David, in which God refers back to what happened and a particular incident. And the particular incident that it's referring to, and in all sorts of subtle ways, Hebrews makes this clear, is what happened at Kadesh Barnea, which is related in Numbers 13 to 14. Here's the story. Moses sent 12 spies into the Promised Land because they were now on the border of the Promised Land. They were up against the Jordan, on the border of the Promised Land, and God said to Moses, in you go, you've arrived, in you go. Moses sends 12 chaps, one from each tribe of Israel, into the Promised Land to have a look and see what they think. And they come back with a cluster of grapes. Nobody knows why. They do. And they report. But there is a majority report and a minority report. The majority report from 10 of them says, yeah, we don't think so. Let's go back to Egypt to be fine. We'll go back to Egypt. This is going to be a nightmare. We haven't got a chance. They're like giants. And we'll get crushed. Joshua and Caleb say, no, it'll be fine. We should definitely go in. You understand I'm paraphrasing again. The people of Israel, including Moses, go with the majority report. And they say, actually, you know, we're going to go back to no. At which point, God bursts onto the scene and says, right, that's it. Because of this, all of you, the whole generation of Israel that came out of Egypt and has got this far, everybody over the age of reason, everybody who's grown up, you're going to die in the wilderness. And you're going to wander around in the wilderness until this whole generation has died. Only Joshua and Caleb will live to enter into the Promised Land. Everybody else died, including Moses, who's let me down big time. At this point, the people repent, but it's too late. God does not relent of this punishment. And so it is then that Joshua is the one who leads the people of Israel into the Promised Land, and not Moses. So why then? Because of faithlessness. And Joshua was superior to Moses precisely in faithfulness, just as the letter to the Hebrews has told us that Jesus is superior to Moses precisely in respect of faithfulness. So he set up this parallel between Joshua and Moses, Joshua and Jesus, both superior to Moses in respect of faithfulness. And in the case of Joshua, the son of Nun, he is therefore going to be the one who can lead the people of Israel into the Promised Land. And he talks about all this and explains that that's precisely what it means. They were unable to enter because of unbelief. But then he goes on to make this very strange point. And this is the weak point, not in my argument, which has no weak points, as you will have noticed, but in the letter to the Hebrews. And it goes like this. That psalm, which I quoted to you, was written by David. Okay, we all know that the psalms are written by David. So therefore, it was written long after the people of Israel had in fact entered into the Promised Land, right? And that David's in Jerusalem, the heart of the Promised Land, all fine. And yet, he has God saying, then, they shall not enter my rest. And so then he goes on to say, if Joshua had given them rest, God would not speak later of another day. Oh, that today you would listen to my voice. Harden not your hearts, never shall they enter my rest. So then, there remains a Sabbath rest for the people of God. For whoever enters God's rest ceases from his labours, as God did from his. So, because David wrote that psalm, the real rest that that psalm is talking about can't be just entering into the Holy Land. There must be some other rest that this never shall they enter my rest really refers to. What is that rest? He asks. And he uses a rabbinic technique called Gezerah Shavah. And Gezerah Shavah means, if you don't know what a word means in one passage of the Bible, you just go and look for it in another passage of the Bible, and it means the same thing there as it does there, so that's fine. So what does rest mean? Well, we all know what it means because it tells you, Book of Genesis, God rested from all his works on the seventh day. So the real rest that rest always means in the Bible is the eternal rest of God himself, the eternal Sabbath, to which all actual Sabbaths, every Saturday, is just a pointer, another type. Celebrating the Sabbath is a way of preparing yourselves to go to heaven, to enter into the eternal rest of God. And that's what Joshua couldn't lead the people of Israel into. But because Joshua could lead the people of Israel into Canaan, which foreshadows entry into the rest of God, unlike Moses, therefore he points forward to the fact that Jesus, who is, if you like, the real Joshua, he's the potato of which Joshua is only an imprint, he is able to lead the people of Israel into the real Sabbath rest of God, which is heaven itself. And thus, and I think I'm going to make this my last point because I can see that your brains are full, and I think so is mine. Thus, we have now these two forms of typology actually come together, because they're both about going to heaven. The, if you like, the vertical typology, I'm doing that and saying vertical. My brain has gone. The vertical typology, that's a better mind for vertical, isn't it? The vertical typology is about how Jesus entered into heaven himself with his own blood, the real heavenly sanctuary, of which the earthly sanctuary is only a shadow, an echo. And he went into heaven itself. So that's a vertical typology, is very obviously about going to heaven, and that's explicit. The horizontal typology is about how the people of Israel, led by Joshua, were finally, when Joshua had succeeded Moses, were finally led across the Jordan and into the promised land. Okay? But now we discover that that promised land is in fact also a type of heaven, entry into God's rest, the ultimate Sabbath, if you will. So this horizontal typology maps onto the vertical typology. And all the letter to the Hebrews has done is the same thing in two different dimensions, using two different sets of potato prints, but actually from the same potato, which is, if you'll remember, Jesus. Or more specifically, the shape of salvation in Jesus Christ. Because the shape of salvation in Jesus Christ is man goes through a thing into a place, right? Joshua goes through the Jordan into the promised land. High priest goes through the veil of the temple into the Holy of Holies. Jesus goes through what? Say that louder. Death. Good. Top of the class. Jesus goes through death and into heaven. So the Jordan is the veil of the temple, is death. Right? Heaven is heaven is heaven, is the promised land, is the rest of God, is the heavenly sanctuary, etc. Man is always really Jesus. And that shape of salvation is stamp, 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 stamp. But what you've got with the horizontal that you haven't got explicitly with the vertical is when man goes through a thing into a place, he leaves the door open behind him, right? When Joshua goes through the Jordan into the promised land, doesn't go on his own, he takes everybody with him, because the waters of the Jordan miraculously part, just like the waters of the Red Sea parted. They part for Joshua, and he can go through and lead everybody else through. So we are allowed to infer that when Jesus, the high priest, passed through the real veil of the temple into the real sanctuary, which is heaven itself, that veil of the temple remained torn open. Now, he talks about this, and this is your homework. He talks about this in chapters 8 and 9 of the letter to the Hebrews, how the veil was torn open. He talks about how there were two tents, the outer tent and the inner tent, is the first tent and the second tent, and they really represent, in a way, they represent earth and heaven, but they also represent the old covenant and the new covenant. So now we can see through the old covenant to the new covenant because the veil has been torn down, so we can pass through. And so we come back to what I quoted to you towards the beginning, Hebrews 10:19. Therefore, brethren, since we have confidence to enter the sanctuary by the blood of Jesus, by the new and living way which he opened for us through the curtain, that is, his flesh, seems to be very obviously a reference to the Eucharist. And since we have a great high priest over the house of God, let us draw near with a true heart in full assurance of faith, with our hearts sprinkled clean from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. Obviously a reference to baptism. So, and this is the last sentence. I mean, might be a semicolon in it. In modern New Testament studies, we're constantly being told that the authentic biblical Christian eschatology is about the resurrection of the body. You read Tom Wright and all these kinds of people on this. And they say it's about the resurrection of the body. That life after death, going to heaven, that's a very kind of pagan slash Platonic idea, semicolon. But in fact, the message of the letter to the Hebrews is perfectly clear, colon. Because Jesus, when he died, did so in perfect obedience to God. And because we are in communion or fellowship with him, we are his brothers in obedience and love. Therefore, when we die, we can go to heaven too. And I say that's good news. Let there be questions. Have at me. Do not be afraid. I don't bite. The gentleman in the front with the checked shirt.
Thank you.
Thank you.
First off, thanks a lot for that. I really, really enjoyed that. And I could probably listen. I probably listen to you talk longer than you can talk.
you'd be amazed how long
I would be in close contacts. I know that in your work you have a bit on sort of the kind of in Hebrews where it sort of lists the heroes of faith towards
yes.
The end.
I missed that whole section out.
And I know that in your book you have a bit on how Jesus is mysteriously left out of that.
Yep.
I was wondering if you might sort of give us your analysis of that and how that fits into your scheme of
okay.
What's happening.
Okay. So thank you. So as I said, three. You're going to get 5 minutes now on this. You know.
That's what I was hoping.
3 and 4, and 11 and 12 match up with each other. They both talk about the same thing. In chapter 11 specifically, he talks about the heroes of faith of Israel. By faith so-and-so did this, by faith so-and-so did that. I'm sure it's familiar to you. Emphasizing, in particular, Abraham. And the fact that Abraham, even when he lived in the Promised Land, he lived as a sojourner. He lived in a tent because he knew he wasn't really in the Promised Land, because the real Promised Land is the heavenly city and not some earthly Jerusalem. But then it does this kind of weird thing. Because it talks about by faith, by faith, by faith. It's the same very repetitive rhetorical structure, and it's quite deliberate. I'm going to have to go there anyway, I can see. It's quite deliberate, and then suddenly it goes wrong. Okay? By faith, if people crossed the Red Sea as if on dry land, but the Egyptians, when they attempted to do the same, were drowned. Fine. By faith, some people did a thing. A good thing. By faith, the walls of Jericho fell down after they'd been encircled for 7 days. Right, who've had faith there? The walls of Jericho? It ought to be the walls of Jericho, because hitherto, by faith, subject did a good thing, and the subject had the faith. Suddenly now we've got the walls of Jericho, who really don't have any faith at all, I happen to know. They are not faithful. Now, so the rhetorical structure there breaks down. At the same time, we've missed a bit, haven't we? By faith the people crossed the Red Sea as if on dry land. By faith the walls of Jericho fell down after they'd been encircled for 7 days. Well, hang on a minute. You know, you missed a whole chunk. We've gone across the Red Sea and suddenly we're in Jericho. It's as if the Red Sea and the River Jordan have been squished together and that whole middle section has been elided. And what happens in that middle section, of course, is that Joshua takes over from Moses and succeeds where he fails. And it seems to me that there is a deliberate elision. I call it a metalepsis in my book. I don't know if you're impressed with that. and a metalepsis is a rhetorical trope quite well known in the classical period by which you miss out the most important thing to draw attention to it. Right? It's like you leave a huge something-shaped gap deliberately to make people see the gap. And I think that there's a huge Joshua-shaped gap there. But I have more arguments for those who don't find that convincing, because I know everybody doesn't. Immediately after that, we have, by faith Rahab the harlot did not perish with those who were disobedient, because she'd given friendly welcome to the spies. Which is true, we know the story, and they hid in her house and so on and so forth. But it also draws our attention to the spies, who were sent by Joshua, and who himself had been a spy in the previous generation. And then, what more shall I say? Or you could also translate it, why am I still talking? A question occurring to many of you now. For time would fail to tell me of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, and Samuel, and the prophets, who through faith conquered kingdoms, enforced justice, received promises, stopped the mouth of lions, quenched raging fire, escaped the edge of the sword, won strength out of weakness, became mighty in war, put foreign armies to flight. Women received their dead by resurrection, some were tortured, suffered mocking, they were stoned and sawn in two, they were killed with the sword, they went about in the skins of sheep and goats. A totally different rhetorical structure has suddenly happened with no ands. Right? No ands. This is quite deliberate. It's called isocolon. And it goes bang, 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 bang. And they're all in the wrong order. There's no... Whereas before, we could follow the salvation historical structure of what he was saying. We knew what was going to come next. Suddenly, it's all a mess. And it's as if there was no development. After this point, there was no development. Now, what I suggest, and it's only very tentative, and I don't insist upon it, but what I suggest is we should have in our minds the picture of a record that got stuck. Anybody here know what records are? I actually have heard them and heard them get stuck. The needle is in the groove of salvation history and it's all going along tremendously well, right? Until we get to the edge of the promised land, and then it goes wrong because the people refuse, and so they won't go in because they don't believe Joshua. And so then it starts to skip, and it stutters and skips, and that's what that passage is with it. Da-dum, and da-dum, 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 the same thing over and over again. No development, no movement, no flow, no soteriological significance to anything that happens ever thereafter. It's all just the same thing over and over again because the needle got stuck until Jesus came along with bang, and now we're back in the groove. And we can carry on. And I think that's the kind of thing that we're probably meant to conclude. But I do have half a chapter on this rather than 5 minutes. And I urge you, when you read my book, to pay particular close attention to that section, because it does make a lot more convincing sense than I did just then. Also, though, there is, since you asked me about chapter 12 as well, right at the, after this passage, there's a lovely chiasm, which is in verses, halfway through 12 verse 1 through to the end of 12:2. Do we know what chiasms are? Shake your head if you don't. Right, okay, so you've got the idea is A, B, C, D, C, B, A. It's the shape of a sentence or an argument or anything that's A, B, C, B, A or A, B, C, D, C, B, A or whatever. Now, it doesn't, annoyingly, it doesn't really work in English, but you have to trust me until you go and look at the Greek to check that this works beautifully in the Greek when he says, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, okay, it's not part of that, it's from this bit on, let us lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with perseverance the race that is set before us, looking to, I'm going to slightly rephrase it to echo the Greek better, looking to the pioneer and perfecter of our faith, Jesus, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of God. So you've got the same ideas repeated twice, A, B, C, B, A, as I say. Please go and look at the Greek or read my book on it, and you'll see that it works. In the first half, it's on that horizontal level. It's talking about running the race that's set before us, making it into the promised land and all that kind of thing. In the second one, it's Jesus doing the same thing on the vertical level. And at the centre of the cross, this chiastic structure like that, named after the Greek letter chi, the middle of it is the name Jesus, looking to the pioneer and perfecter of our faith, Jesus. And it seems to me that right at the climax of his argument, what he wants to do, again, is draw attention to the name of Jesus. Jesus is hardly ever named in the letter to the Hebrews. When he is, it's always significant. He's always drawing attention to the fact that it's Jesus and not a Messiah called Fred or Angela or Brian. It's always Jesus, and it matters that he's called Jesus, because as the angel says to Joseph at the beginning of St. Matthew's Gospel, and you shall call his name Jesus, because he will save the people from their sins. So it does matter. That was a long answer to a short, sensible question. Sorry about that. Who's next?
So one question I had to do with the for the audience of this letter was written, or the sermon, I guess, that given these different levels of typology and
yes,
the complexity of it,
yes,
to what degree are these sophisticated people reading that? Is this sort of a synagogue type of a
sure? That's a good question, and it's problematic. We don't know, of course. All you can infer about the audience is what you've got in the text. We know that there were, or we fairly know, as much as we know anything about the ancient world, there were synagogues where there were Christians. That is to say, they were Jews, they lived Jewish lives, but they believed that Jesus was the Messiah and the fulfillment of the promises of God to Israel. It seems to me that's the most likely congregation, generally speaking, or audience, if you prefer. They clearly are expected to be well-versed in the scriptures, because there are all sorts of allusions to the scriptures that the epistle only makes sense if you pick up on these things. I'm not saying, as many biblical scholars do, unless you accept my theory about Hebrews doesn't make any sense. There are biblical scholars who say, I, after 2,000 years, have finally unlocked the mysteries of such and such a book. Appalling arrogance. I don't make any such claim at all. But there are passages where you would clearly have to pick things up in order really for it to make sense. I suspect that the author, the human author of the letter to the Hebrews, and I'm convinced that the divine author of the letter to the Hebrews, thought that there were some people who could pick up on this. And it's not about a kind of careful, detailed, every I dotted and every T crossed kind of systematic presentation of theology. It's exactly the kind of hand-wavy sort of thing that I've done today is much more suited really to it, actually, than a doctoral thesis. Because it's kind of, it's appealing to imagery, it's appealing to a whole set of undeveloped, half-formed ideas. Nobody had sat down and worked all this out and explained how typology works. But there were just these ideas floating around in the air, which linked in both with kind of Platonic thought and also with Jewish apocalyptic eschatological thought, and about how God works, about the power of God, And certainly they were aware of the importance of names. There is a theory about the Book of Chronicles, which I think is probably right, that every king suffers or enjoys a fate which is appropriate to the literal meaning of his name. So go back and look at the Book of Chronicles, read it in Hebrew, and you'll see that that works. Or read the book, the name of which escapes me, but it'd be obvious when you look in the library and section on Chronicles. I think they were very much more conscious than we are that when you have a name, that kind of seals your fate. And names matter. And I think that it appeals to all of these ideas. And so even if you didn't go home, and clearly nobody did, or they'd have written this down, and there are hints that people got this in the patristic writers, but nobody kind of unpacks it all completely. But I think you would have gone home just with a very strong sense that Jesus is Joshua, he has led us into the real promised land, it's all fulfilled, it all kind of makes sense. And that's as much as I'd want to claim, I think, about the hearers. Whether those hearers were actually in the congregation, it's impossible to know, but I think they were present in the mind of the preacher when he was preaching to them.
Right.
And none of us preach to the congregation that's actually there. The preacher preaches first of all to himself, and secondly to the people he wishes were there. Yeah.
I was just wondering if you could expand on a couple points you made really briefly. First, you said if we were interested, you could expand on the significance of Jesus purifying heaven.
Yes, it's odd, isn't it?
Yeah, and then secondly, you mentioned another typological connection between the church and the wandering people of Israel rather than the nation of Israel. And I'm
yes.
Right? And so I'm just wondering if that's still...
Sure.
Is that still how... Is that the lens that we should look at the current church through still?
Yeah, I think so. Well, yes and no. So I'll come back to that question in a second. The first question was... what was the first question about?
Jesus purifying.
Thank you very much. So yes, the heavenly places need better sacrifices than these. That's a very odd thing to say, isn't it? There is the suggestion, I think Luther came up with it, that it's talking about Satan being cast down from heaven. I don't think that's right. There's no suggestion of it. And the word purify is perhaps slightly misleading. Perhaps the word that we would want is more... sanctify or even inaugurate. I'm going to go for inaugurate, and I'll tell you why. The first covenant, the Mosaic covenant, finally, as it were, is inaugurated. The ribbon is cut when Moses goes into the tent, having built it with blood, and splashes it about. That is the equivalent of the ribbon cutting ceremony, and it takes place in the Holy of Holies on the first ever Yom Kippur, and it inaugurates the Mosaic Covenant. I think the suggestion that's going on is that Christ, when he entered into heaven, went into the real Holy of Holies in heaven, and inaugurated the real covenant, which is the heavenly covenant, which was foreshadowed by and which fulfills the Mosaic Covenant. So it's really about that. It's about saying, we've got a new inauguration going on of a new covenant. So it's not the suggestion, I think, that that heaven is dirty and needs to be cleaned. It's the suggestion, not that heaven itself needs to be inaugurated, but that the covenant which is located in heaven needs to be inaugurated, just as the first covenant is located, as it were, in the Holy of Holies, and so that had to be cleansed, in huge scare quotes, if that makes sense.
Yeah, you kind of mentioned as well that the idea that the blood was to sort of get rid of the year's sins that were sort of slowly creeping in.
Yes, exactly.
Is that element part of that, or is it purely an inauguration?
I think it might be that there is some suggestion. It's hard. It's really hard to read because you're talking about reading between the lines of Leviticus. And even reading the lines of Leviticus, never mind, between the lines, but there does seem to be some suggestion that blood acts as a kind of ritual detergent that cleanses the pollution caused by sin. So it's not that these places are dirty, but that they are, if you like, the holiness of them is threatened by this kind of fungal sin that creeps in everywhere. And you've got to get this ritual detergent or this ritual fungicide, which is blood. Why blood? Because blood is the life, and the life belongs to God. Mm-hmm. So there's something holy about blood, in as much as it represents the life-giving power of God. So it might be that there was a sense in which heaven was, as it were, threatened in the same way of being infected in some sense by our sins. Not in itself, but in its functionality. That is to say, heaven won't do us any good if we cover it over with sin, or something like that.
Covenantal renewal.
Exactly. But again, these ideas are not worked out in detail. This is not systematic theology. This is hand-wavy preaching. Your second question, I've now forgotten, was...
Looking at... Do we still look at the contemporary church through that idea
good.
Of
yes.
that typology?
On this, definitely read, though ultimately he's wrong, Ernst Käsemann's The Wandering People of God. The first half is really good. Second half is crazy because it starts talking about Gnostic myths that just didn't exist at the time. But the first half is one of the best expositions of Hebrews I've ever read. And he points out that there is this parallel between specifically the wilderness generation of Israel and the church. So we are, of course we are Israel, but when are we Israel? Or we are the Israel of when? And he would say, we are the wandering people of God. I would want to qualify that slightly, because so wandering implies hither and yon. Mm-hmm. I think we are the pilgrim people of God, because we're going somewhere, namely the heavenly Jerusalem. But B, that we are actually really nearly there. We're the really nearly there people of God. We are on the threshold of the promised land. Because the whole purpose of the whole letter to the Hebrews, if you read it, is basically to say, one more step. That's all it takes. The door is open. The waters are parted. The veil has been torn in two. All you've got to do is step through. It's right there. If you want it. It's not difficult. It's right there. We are on the threshold of heaven itself. And so we are, if you like, the Israel, which is the type of the church, is the Israel that day at Kadesh Barnea, when God said to them, there it is, in you go. And they said no. So he says, sorry, let me find it again. This book won't stay open. He says, right. Therefore, while the promise of entering his rest remains, let us fear, lest any of you be judged to fail to reach it. For good news came to us just as to them. So that, what's that good news? That's Joshua and Caleb reporting back. Well, we've got Jesus reporting back from heaven by the Holy Spirit and by the scriptures and so on. But the message which they heard did not benefit them because it did not meet with faith in their hearers. And he says, I'm not going to be able to find the passage now, but he basically says somewhere that we are in exactly the same situation. Let us therefore strive to enter that rest, that no one fall by the same sort of disobedience. So we're in the same position now that they were in then. We can choose, obey, disobey. Trust, don't trust. Believe God when he tells you, go in if you like, or say, not sure about this, might go back to Egypt. Those are the people of Israel that we are. Yes?
Could you distinguish and talk about like typology, symbolism, and allegory, and, like the relationship between those? Or
I do, just kind of in a more or less in an aside, towards the end of my typology, methodology chapter. Yeah. And what I suggest is that whereas with allegory, you're saying, this isn't a true story, but it's about something true. Okay, that's allegory. So for example, The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe is the classic example, right? Even though C.S. Lewis denied it was an allegory. We all read it as an allegory. So Aslan is Jesus. The stone table is the cross. Edmund is Adam, probably, etc. Okay? But of course, the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe is made up. Mm-hmm. Right? It didn't happen. So we can say, well, it's an allegory. A typology is where it's real and it points beyond itself. So it's not just the words which seem to refer to one thing, but really are about something else. Right? It's in typology, the words really do refer to the things they're talking about. Okay? At least, I mean, whatever you believe, the author of Hebrews really thought that there was a Joshua who really did lead the people of Israel through a real River Jordan into a real Canaan, right? But that the meaning of those events points beyond itself, so that the events become a signpost, rather than the words, which seem to be about A, are actually about B. And that, for me, is the difference between a typological and an allegorical reading. You're saying, yes, it's true, but it means more. But the events, which are true events, mean more than they seem to mean. Mm-hmm. Happily, that's a very Thomist way of talking about figural readings of scriptures. Okay, do we think I've got away with it? Okay, I've got one more then.
Wow, one more. Well, you picked on Tom Wright, sort of.
I did pick on him a little bit.
Which is fine.
God bless him. Lovely man.
Yeah, I've not met him, but
I've already. His wife makes lovely soup.
Right. So, one question about that. So obviously he's looking at the whole new heavens, new earth thing. So when he says something like, well, heaven's great and everything, but it's not the end of the world, what he means by that is that, in some sense, heaven and earth coming together is the image that the Bible really is representing. I don't think that's wrong. Right.
I don't think that's wrong. I just think that you can't insist that there is a biblical doctrine which is clear-cut and which every book of the Bible ascribes to equally clearly, with no kind of wiggle room, if you like. I mean, Christians do believe in the general resurrection. We do believe in the transformation, a new heaven and a new earth. We do believe in the heavenly Jerusalem coming down. But we also think you go to heaven when you die, if you're good, eventually. At least, plow your way through purgatory if you believe in purgatory, but you go to heaven when you die. And that, although that isn't the end of the story, it's pretty damn good. Okay? And in fact, there is almost nothing in the letter to the Hebrews about resurrection. Either the resurrection of Christ or the resurrection of the body, the general resurrection. It's about the ascension. You know how in John's Gospel, there are those lifted up sayings. When I am lifted up, will draw all men to myself. Moses lifted up serpent, so must the Son of Man be lifted up. And clearly that kind of brings the crucifixion and the resurrection together. But what actually it does, and what Hebrews does even more clearly, is the crucifixion segues immediately into the heavenly exaltation of Jesus. When Jesus is lifted up on the cross, he's lifted up into heaven. And in fact, Hebrews is very similar in this respect to the well-known passage from Philippians 2, though he was in the form of God and all that. Even death on a cross, therefore God has highly exalted him. It's like as soon as you get to the bottom, you're at the top. And that's what Hebrews thinks as well. When you get to the bottom, you're at the top. But Hebrews, like Philippians, thinks that when Jesus got to the bottom, that was when he entered into the depths of the human condition. Then when he whizzed up to the top again, he took us with him. Which is why I talk very often about soteriological scooping, that as you know, Christ, as it were, descends from heaven to earth, and then at his death, a resurrection and ascension, he ascends, but he's picked us up by the scruff of the neck and taken us with him. Soteriological scooping. Matthew.
I don't want to take so long, but this might be a good one because hopefully we get some take homes with it as well. If as you're saying, and I mean I think as the author of Hebrews is saying, if Joshua is a type of Jesus, then I think what this would then mean would be that in studying Joshua and looking at Joshua's life and his story and his deeds, that we can learn things about Jesus from that.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think for us as people who may read Joshua, might be familiar with the story of these, what kinds of things do you think that the author or preacher, letter of Hebrews, we call him Paul for short, what do you think that he would want us to take from Joshua's story, from the book of Joshua itself, as far as, hey, this is what we can learn about Jesus, this is what you can see about
that
Jesus.
That's a very good and interesting question. And Joshua is a very problematic book and a very problematic character. But I'm going to say that the fundamental message of the book of Joshua... Okay, I'm going to say more than this, but I am going to say the fundamental message of the book of Joshua is that... the sin is idolatry. That we are constantly subject to the temptation to put God aside and make do with something more accessible, more immediate, easier to worship, more straightforward and simpler. And Joshua is constantly insistent that that is not acceptable. That the Canaanites represent idolatry. And there can be no compromise with idolatry. There can be no compromise with anything which dethrones God or which puts something in the place of God, which makes do with something less than God. And that really is the message of the book of Joshua. Even if, it, for a non-Christian, as it were, that's what you would get out of the book of Joshua. And, of course, Jesus is the only human being who has never allowed anything to replace God, because he is God. The only human being who has never wavered for a moment in his absolute obedience to the Father, and who makes no compromise. He makes no compromise with the kingdoms of this world, because his kingdom is not of this world. So I think something along those lines. I also think that Joshua is portrayed as the last of the prophets. He's the last person in the Bible who ever speaks to God face to face. So he's the last of the prophets in a sense, in that sense of prophets, and the first of the kings, even though, of course, he's never king. But he somehow sums up both the prophetic and the kingly in his soteriological career, if you like, and he shows us then what it is to be a prophet and to be a king. And again, it's about that absolute dedication to the service of the Lord. And then one thing which is a slightly let's say cheeky point is that Joshua always consults the priests, and that is something we can all take a lesson from. Yes.
Thank you very much for a stimulating presentation. My question doesn't derive from it, but I'm just curious whether you have a guess yourself as to the author of the book of Hebrews, whether it's Timothy or Apollos.
I don't. I mean, in the end, I more or less dismissed the question in less than a paragraph in my book, simply because I don't think it's knowable.
Yeah.
And therefore, I don't think there's any point getting sidetracked by it. I'm confident that it's not Paul, Parche Matthew here, because the author clearly portrays himself as of the second generation of the post-apostolic, in a certain sense, generation. He is somebody who's received the gospel from the apostles. There's no way Paul would ever have said that. Or if he did, then he didn't write Galatians. And if Paul didn't write Galatians, then we need a new definition of Paul. but it was a man, because he applies to himself a masculine participle at one point. So either it's a man or it's a woman pretending to be a man, which is what some people think. And I've read the theory that it was Priscilla. A very modern theory says it must be a woman. This is a feminist theologian, it doesn't sound very feminist to me. Must be a woman because Hebrews, unlike the Pauline epistles, manifests all sorts of feminine qualities. A, no it doesn't, and B, what? I've read the theory that it was written by the Blessed Virgin Mary. I don't think that's very likely. I would say it's definitely by a Jew. It's definitely by a Christian. is definitely by somebody who knew his Septuagint inside out and back to front. It's definitely by somebody who's immersed in what you might call Middle Platonism, that is to say the broad philosophical milieu which knew about Plato and it knew about the Stoics and the Epicureans and so on. And so my best guess is that it's somebody in Alexandria, because that's where somebody like that would probably live, or at least it's the least unlikely place for somebody like that to live. And I think it was written to Italy, from Rome, which explains better those from Italy send greeting. That's not a thing you'd write if you're in Italy. Everybody's from Italy in Italy. Whereas if you're in Alexandria, writing to Romans, people from Italy send greetings makes perfect sense. That just means from somewhere outside Italy. But best guess, probably Alexandria, a Jewish Christian, a great preacher. That doesn't actually fit any of the people we've ever heard of from the right period, which is the second half of the first century AD, which is when I think it was written, and I don't know any more than that about when it was written either. I think there's this tendency among some scholars to say it must be by someone we've heard of. And so let's make a list of all the people we've heard of: Timothy, Apollos, Priscilla, Blessed Virgin Mary, Paul. None of them fit. And so it's almost certainly by somebody we've never heard of, which is very frustrating. But yeah, let's call him Paul. As long as we're clear, it's a different Paul. Thank you.
Maybe if there's one more, we may have time.
Okay. I haven't worked at the time in a while. Actually, that's around the time we normally wrap up, so that's
there we go. That worked out perfectly in the end, didn't it?
Yes. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. Very listening.
Just only really a couple things.